Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box with my very special guest host, Saad Ali. Welcome back to the show, Saad.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
You were here on episode 103. We talked a little bit about storage. We didn't talk a lot about the CNCF Technical Oversight Committee, of which you are a member. And I understand you have some new colleagues just joined you this week.
That's right. We've got a bunch of new TOC members.
So the TOC is elected by various different groups. The governing board elected three candidates this time: Aaron Boyd from Apple, Cornelia Davis from Weaveworks, and Lei Zhang from Alibaba. And the end user community elected Dave Zolotusky from Spotify and Ricardo Rocha from CERN, who's my favorite because he's been on the show.
That's right. Really excited to work with them.
What's changed and what's new in the CNCF of late?
Really, it's been focusing on how to make projects more successful and to figure out how to get projects into the CNCF. So over the last year, we've worked on revising the process for adding projects to the CNCF sandbox. And, you know, it used to be that you had to go and talk to a TOC member, get them to sponsor you. That whole process has been streamlined now, and there is an application process, and the TOC regularly reviews applications. And really, we've actually lowered the bar for joining the CNCF sandbox. And the goal has been simply to make it easy to collaborate amongst multiple companies on a given project, and it becomes a way to kind of increase the innovation in the ecosystem. And we kind of removed the requirement for projects to have to move to incubation or move to graduation, which frees us up to adopt more projects in the sandbox as we go forward. Now, moving forward into the next year, what we want to do is see if we can improve the process for incubation and graduation as well.
One of the things that you don't get to do with these people is obviously meet them in person. What do you miss the most about not going to KubeCons and conferences or even out of the house in general, perhaps?
Yeah, no, it's really, really just seeing people in the hallway, bumping into them, talking to them, and seeing the face behind the GitHub IDs. It's really just helps you connect with people on a different level, and I really miss that. Looking forward to being able to do that again.
What's the best meal you ever had on a conference trip?
You know what? It would have to be this Malaysian roti I had in London, and I can't remember the place. It was a little hole-in-the-wall place, and it was delicious, and I think I went back two or three times.
I know a lot of people don't think England is famous for its haute cuisine, but there is a lot of good food to be had around here, in better times at least.
Definitely. It seems like they've adopted the food from all over the world.
It's one thing that England is very good at is adopting things from all over the world, and on occasion they're asked to give them back again. Elgin marbles. Well, shall we get to the news?
Let's get to the news. Congratulations to the Open Policy Agent, which is now a graduated project in the CNCF. The announcement was made in a blog post written by Tim Henricks and Torin Sandahl, guests from episode 101 of the podcast. Listen to that episode to learn all about the project.
Docker Distribution, the registry that powers Docker Hub, has been donated to the CNCF sandbox. Distribution is a rewrite in Go of the original Python Docker registry. It has been adopted as the base of many other registries, such as those from GitHub and GitLab, and Docker's CTO Justin Cormack says that maintainers from those forks have been approached to become maintainers of the new project, now just called Distribution.
In more registry news, Red Hat announced version 3.4 of their Quay registry. This is the commercially supported version of the Quay open source project. Quay is written in Python and has migrated to Python 3, as well as offering new versions of their operator and updated Clair security scanner. Quay was proposed as a CNCF project last year, but has not yet completed that process.
The Unit 42 group at Palo Alto Networks has discovered a Kubernetes cryptojacking malware, which they have termed Hildegard. Breaking in via a kubelet, which was configured to allow anonymous access, the malware spreads inside a Kubernetes cluster and mines Monero, which I believe is the only cryptocurrency Elon Musk hasn't tweeted about this week. The attackers call themselves Team TNT, which I sincerely hope is different to the people who created the fourth episode of the original Doom back in the mid-90s. If you want to know how an attack like this might work, a blog post from Eduardo Baitello coincidentally explains how to get full node access by attacking the kubelet.
Jetstack, the creators of Cert Manager, has announced a public beta of a service based on it. JetStack Secure provides visibility of machine identities using an open source agent on your cluster and a web UI, which is either SaaS or run in your cluster with the Enterprise Edition. You can try OneNode for free, and the paid version will include multi-cluster, enterprise CA, and service mesh support, with some features arriving throughout the year.
The Trafic proxy has released version 2.4, adding support for the proxy protocol on TCP services and dynamic support for mutual TLS. This release also adds support for using Trafic as a gateway with the new experimental services APIs in Kubernetes. If you'd like to use Trafic as an ingress gateway for Istio, a blog post from Tetrate this week talks about how to do just that.
API gateways are all the rage this week, with Kong announcing general availability of Kong Connect, with two Ks, their commercial service management platform. Connect runs as a cloud-hosted control plane with agents on your cluster and operates a central service catalog. Kong also announced $100 million of Series D funding, taking them to a valuation of $1.4 billion. And making the gorilla a unicorn.
Early access tickets are now available to KubeCon EU, to be held virtually May 4th through 7th. Buy yourself or someone you love a ticket before Valentine's Day and pay only $10 versus the $75 your ticket will cost afterwards. 7 co-located events have been announced, including days for Edge, Security, Service Mesh, WebAssembly, and Rust.
You can build your containers with a Docker file, or you can just write code using a build pack to do the containerizing for you. Genevieve L'Esperance from Doximity explores both these options in a blog post this week and talks about why they have moved their developers to Paquito build packs, citing developer productivity, security, and performance benefits.
Finally, lighting up the message boards this week, a post by Lucas Skugor on why he doesn't feel Helm fits the Kubernetes ecosystem. Any other week, this may not have made the cut for our news, but Skugor cites a talk from Saad on Kubernetes design principles and why he doesn't think Helm fits them, and seeing as I have Saad here with me.
Overall, I think it's a well-written philosophical argument that makes a lot of good points. Fundamentally, Kubernetes introduces a new problem, YAML hell. There are a lot of projects trying to solve this problem. Shout out to Kep from Google, another project in this space trying to address this. Discussions like this one are good and hopefully will result in pushing the space to something better for users.
And that's the news. Michael Gerstenhaber is a director of product management at Datadog. He works on metrics in the container ecosystem and compiles the annual Datadog Container Report. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hi, great to meet you. Thank you.
You started out at Cisco working on network management. What's the difference between management and monitoring?
Network management was bidirectional. We were monitoring the routers and switches, the switching fabric, the firewalls and everything, but we were also pushing changes. It was central place that abstracted whether or not you were abstracting into virtual network elements, whether you were using a Cisco device or Juniper device or whatever. You could push one change and it would provision those changes. With monitoring, it really is more about receiving telemetry and aggregating and acting on data programmatically. The configuration management tools, our solutions, our partners in the ecosystem like Chef or Puppet or Ansible that we partner with rather than make those write changes directly.
It still freaks me out when I hear people talk about iOS. It makes me tweak something in my brain and say, oh yeah, that's right. That's not what I think it means these days.
Yeah, that's right. It's funny when I was moving from Cisco Systems, right? At the beginning of my career, it was 2006 and this was my first job and iOS, the Apple version, didn't even exist yet. So when people started talking about it, it was very much internet working operating system for me, the Cisco operating systems on the routing and switches.
Now, you were an engineer there for some time and then you left to become a product manager at a startup.
Yeah, I left engineering. I was 29. I thought I was going to be an engineer my entire life, but a very good friend of mine was starting a company in the video game industry. He was fundraising, he was selling, and he just needed somebody to talk to the engineers, to talk to the customers, and make product decisions. That's how I accidentally fell into product management. As we wound down the startup and I joined Datadog, I moved back from video games into where I was comfortable in monitoring what I had learned at Cisco Systems, but this time on the product side rather than on the engineering side.
A lot of people like to look back on their startup and say, hey, we had a great idea, but the time was wrong or the market fit wasn't there. Do you have any opinion on that particular technology or that particular time?
I quite enjoyed the experience. I think there was some small degree to which we were a little bit early in video game streaming. We were also doing video game streaming in a very specific way. The traditional tools that were advertising video game streaming, the PlayStation came out with a version also when they bought Gaikai, they would render everything on a data center, either in the cloud or on their own data centers, and stream the video and capture input, right? But there's latency in both directions there. And if you want to click the button and throw the punch or kill the zombie or whatever it is, right, that latency has to be certainly sub 100 milliseconds, but preferably, I think people think about like 15 millisecond latencies at this point, which is very hard to achieve when you're encoding and decoding video. So the direction that we took as a differentiator here, or our path to market, was to watch what the system was requesting from the hard drive into RAM, into volatile memory, because when you load into a level, that's literally what is happening, right? You load a bunch of textures and music into memory and you play out of fast volatile memory. And the idea here is that we were able to move the hard disk, the 60 gigabyte download, the 120 gigabyte download, out to the cloud, and you could still use your local hardware for processing, and you would still get local hardware speeds.
So you're kind of like level 5, level 6 cache for the CPU.
That's a good analogy. This also allowed me to go to publishers and just wrap their game without seeing the source code, because we were just watching data ranges being fetched and creating this giant statistical map based on what other people had played. So even in open world games where there weren't necessarily levels that were discretized that way, Lord of the Rings Online or whatever, we could see this tree and then that tree and know that you were moving at 5 millimeters per second in that direction and download the next tree.
So you've now landed at Datadog. What was the first project you took on when you joined?
That landing was very interesting. I was winding down the startup that I was working on that I had poured quite a bit of myself into. I was thinking about what I wanted to do next. I used a number of monitoring tools at Happy Cloud, and that's how I came to know about Datadog and get excited about the company. So when I joined, I was working on what's now called the Live Processes product, which allows you to aggregate or filter all of your proc file system over all of your hosts. If you have 40,000 hosts, you don't have to look at that proc file system one by one. You can say, show me all of the Postgres wherever it runs, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we're in this particular conversation, because when I was having those interviews in the very first months of my work at Datadog, I came upon a customer who I'm sure knows who he is even to this day, who said, I would never use this. I would never use this product. And I asked why. And he said, because I use the containers. And again, remember, forgive me here, because Kubernetes was less than a year old at the time. I said, what's a container? And he just spent the next 3 hours explaining everything in the world to me. It was a wonderful experience. And I came home back to the office and said, that's it. We have to put a pin in Live Processes. An inventory of containers is just a pivot table of a list of processes aggregated by C Group. So we were able to use the same UI, ship a container-focused product. And in the meantime, I was able to come up to speed on what containers users needed. Normally, that's not an inventory. This was just one feature. But then I started working on the metrics product and the container product more broadly after that.
It's obviously very convenient if you have something which just deals with processes, and really that's all containers are. It makes it very quick to go to market.
Exactly. We were able to change the direction of that product and ship something within a month or two. It was very, very, very fast. And we still did launch the Live Processes product afterward. It was just clear that there was more urgency in the container side of the world.
When you're dealing with network hardware, like back at Cisco, if you have one device go offline, then that's a problem and someone should be sent out to look at it. But when you start dealing with aggregation of processes or containers that make up a system, now you're dealing with failure as being expected. You're running an unreliable cloud hardware, you're architecting for software failure, and you have to start treating things in the aggregate.
It's not even that you have to expect or architect for failure. You architect for scaling, right? You're intentionally scaling these things up and down in order to run efficiently, right? Mm-hmm. I say this slightly arrogantly, but you can always throw money at an uptime problem. But the idea behind engineering is often to build an efficient system, not just a robust system. People scaled down without failures, right? People were scaling down intentionally. It's an evolution in the same direction, but the scale is much different. So when I came to Datadog, we were talking, and again, this was 4 years ago, we were talking about people moving to the cloud, making digital transformations in a way that we're talking about moving to containers these days. So they were getting used to ephemeral architecture at all. Datadog introduced tagging and aggregation, which are concepts that I think are more taken for granted these days. But as we move into containers, the cardinality, the set of signals that underlies the aggregation has exploded by 100, 1,000 times.
How do you think the industry had to change in terms of any event where you would remove a server would have a similar event in the monitoring system where you would say, stop monitoring that. But now you have to observe the state of things and be able to handle those scale down events because they will happen.
When you were rack and stacking your own hardware, you might have been monitoring those hosts. Now you're monitoring arbitrary objects. The obvious one is the service, and that's where traditional APM comes in. But you want to know that your Kafka topics are healthy, even if your Kafka hosts come and go. You want to make sure that your queue offsets are okay, that your Nginx connections per second is healthy, right? So for any system, not just for your services in application performance monitoring, there are key aggregates, your Kubernetes namespaces or kube deployments or whatever, that you want to monitor that are much more persistent than the underlying signals that inform them, right? Pods come and go, but you rev a version on a deployment. Replica sets even come and go, but you don't really tear down the entire deployment very frequently.
SRE talks about golden signals, which are things like the latency of a service, and that you don't even look at the CPU usage necessarily. You look at outside things that relate to how the service is perceived by the people who are using it.
Precisely. And we think of these things. The golden signals is a great model. We also think about work metrics and resource metrics. Work metrics are those metrics that impact the customer. Again, with services, they are the golden signals, the number of requests, the latency of the service, but every work signal has a resource signal. That resource signal is a work signal for something else. Your database might cause latency. There is probably somebody who wakes up in the middle of the night who needs to understand why database queries are slow, even if that only might impact the end user if it's causing the service above it to be slow. There are locks on that database and CPU that informs why those locks might be happening. It's turtles all the way down, sort of.
And you mentioned before that you can always throw money at the scaling problem. Like, you can have good results on your signals that are caused by a very inefficient system. How should I think about monitoring the ratio, perhaps, between how good my external facing signals are and how much I'm paying to maintain them?
Right. And I don't want to overstate that, right? There are hard engineering problems that are not just solved by scaling up too far, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't mean to overstate that too much, but you do want to monitor your system so that as you scale down, you maintain a high quality of service for your customers. And that exhibits itself in work metrics and the golden signals. You have some SLI, which is latency, and you have an objective for that SLI. I want to keep latency under 200 milliseconds per query end to end, no matter how many parts of my system it touches. And I want to scale down as long as that latency stays below my SLO. If it goes above my SLO, I need to scale back up because I'd rather my customers have a good experience than save a buck.
Since 2015, Datadog has been publishing a survey on container usage. Back in 2015, it was first of all called the Docker Report. It became the Container Orchestration Report and then the Container Report. That in and of itself, I think, is an interesting view of the history of how we think about this space.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially with the recent changes between Docker and container in Kubernetes land, I think it's starting to hit the engineer at the keyboard. But this entire ecosystem, right? Kubernetes is what, 6.5 years old now?
I remember it had a fifth birthday and then time kind of went crazy after that. And I don't know where we are.
That's where I am. Yeah, that's exactly how I was trying to remember it, as being in Barcelona at the fifth birthday. Anyway, it is a young technology, right? And these things are changing. First, you had a safe multi-tenancy with Docker. And then we realized that safe multi-tenancy was nice, but to get real value out of it, layering on an API-centric entry point and orchestration let you take advantage of that multi-tenancy. Now, instead of having to find a bunch of hosts to run my container on, I could use Kubernetes to just say run 5 of them and, you know, everything else would work out just great. Now we realize that the API layer doesn't have to exist in both places, and Containerd, Cryo might be lighter weight than Docker, and it'll continue to evolve. We're not going to stop here or anything.
Let's turn our time machine back to those happier days and look at some of the figures from that first survey. Say Docker adoption is up 5x between 2014 and 2015, from 1.8% of Datadog customers to 8.3%. I'd imagine the number's quite a lot higher today.
Yes, although I think it's funny because you see this like very linear growth, right? That fact is one that we don't really include in the report as frequently anymore because it just looks the same. Mm-hmm. Sure, it's more than 50% of our customers, but it's just been growing that entire time. And it's less surprising these days.
Yes, it says here Docker's gone from 0 to 6% of hosts in 1 year. To the moon.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, 4 years later, it's more than half, right? And that's enterprise customers, and that's startups, and that's everybody.
Docker hosts often run 4 containers at a time.
So that's also one that gets updated frequently in the early years, right? First, it was the median was 4, then it was 5, 6, 8, but then orchestration came along. And there's one fact, I think last year or the year before, where you see there's a huge divergence, right? Orchestrated containers suddenly running several factors above in density, which I think illustrates the reason people are moving to orchestration, right? It's so that natural scheduling and bin packing happens on their behalf, and you can run at a higher density and get more efficient use of resources.
How is this data collected? You're obviously looking at the workloads of your customers. First of all, do you have to ask their permission in order to get this kind of data? And are you looking only, in the early days especially, only at a small subset of the people? Would you say this was representative of everyone using Docker at the time? Was the overlap between sort of the Datadog user of the time and the Docker user of the time about right?
So in order to collect the data, we anonymize some tens of thousands of customers across lots of verticals. We have customers who use Datadog or customers that have web apps that have a website, right? Mm-hmm. They're not in any one industry. So that's representative from that perspective. I think we made a lot of early investments in Docker and especially Kubernetes. So back then, it's possible that we were biased towards early adopters of the technology. It was 1%. There was noise, 1%, 5% of our customers, which has its own volatility. But in terms of what that represented about the industry, it might have been overstating it. I think these days, 50% of our customers using it, and you've been going to KubeCons, you've seen it grow from 500 people to 12,000 to whatever it was this year virtually, which was some enormous number.
I do remember it was a very long walk between booths at Barcelona.
Yes, it was. We all see the industry going there. I think it's representative in part because of my own experience, where our customers are Fortune 500, Fortune 100 enterprises, and they are the long tail of tiny startups. They're unicorn startups. There's no like obvious segmentation to me to say that this is not representative. And I think it's a good cross-section of the engineering population.
So when you have a big data set like that, how do you decide which questions to ask of it?
A lot of it is product-driven. The original intention here was to help us make intelligent investments, right? Mm-hmm. Are people using containers? Is this the right place to invest? What does this mean for metric cardinality? Do people need container ID tagging, or is this preferable to aggregate out that value and offer the Kubernetes deployment or the container image as the atomic unit? Now, obviously, we do offer both, but that was just a question that I had. That was an open question in my mind as a product manager. We thought it would be interesting for the community at large to have these same answers. If they were affecting my roadmap, then probably engineers at the keyboard were interested in my findings as well, because everybody was trying to figure it out. You see a LinkedIn advertisement for a job or something, and it says 10 years of Kubernetes experience. You sort of laugh, but everybody is figuring out best practices, right? Everybody is figuring out, should I be doing bin packing? Does bin packing expand my failure domain in an unacceptable way? There are lots of considerations here, and I think best practices are still being figured out. And if I'm looking for my own benefit, hopefully everybody else benefits as well. So you see a change in the kind of questions we're asking. And these days it's, are people doing that bin packing? Are people setting requests and limits on their containers efficiently, or are they afraid of the killer and throttling? The questions change over time. We still do look at the old questions, but I think we've sort of settled on well-known answers for them, and we're just looking for drift from what we expect. And the reports change to that same extent.
Are there any concrete examples you can share of things that you perhaps weren't planning to do, or product changes that you made as a result of doing this research?
First of all, there's the investment in containers itself, right? Mm-hmm. We have quite a large team working on container integrations. Containers are a technology, right? When we make changes, yes, we have experts, we have people focused maniacally on the container experience, but when you're writing an APM product, it's not like you're not writing a containers product. You are also writing a containers product there. So spreading that knowledge, having a central team, but also moving that knowledge into the rest of the company was a real investment. We also made certain choices. We are running entirely on Kubernetes these days. Mm-hmm. Rob Ball and Laurent Bernay have a great talk at KubeCon Barcelona about how we run our infrastructure and what we have found in that infrastructure. But part of the reason to move there is for our own benefit in infrastructure land, for all the reasons that containers and Kubernetes are great, but also so that we know where our customers are coming from, right? The great thing about being a monitoring company, a multi-tenant SaaS provider, is that our customers are also, in many cases, large multi-tenant systems, right? Mm-hmm. We use Datadog to monitor Datadog, and it's important that we have that empathy for where our customers are coming from. And even our customers that are running largely on-prem with traditional networks are often putting their feet in both ponds and moving from one to the other, either as a permanent step or as a migration. So through these reports, we also recognize the importance of running like our customers were running, and we did move our own infrastructure there as well.
Let's have a look now at the most recent report, which was released in November. We start by saying Kubernetes runs in half of container environments, and nearly 90% of containers are orchestrated. So what's the other half?
The other half is ECS, right? ECS and Kubernetes have completely dominated the orchestration market. Mm-hmm. ECS obviously is a first-party service by Amazon, so it's not an option for people not running in their data centers. Even in AWS data centers, Kubernetes is extremely popular. Their EKS product has seen enormous adoption since it's launched. I think all of these tools are very good. The goal here for engineers is to be able to, again, have this one entry point for their apps and be able to not worry about where the apps are running now that there isn't resource level noisy neighbor problem for CPU and memory.
Later on in the report, we go to talk about the fact that the managed services from the clouds tend to dominate on their own platform. If you're running on GCP, for example, it says here you're roughly 90% likely to be running GKE. But if you're running on Amazon, you're maybe half chance you'll be running EKS and half a chance you'll be running yourself. Do you think that is a function of the fact that EKS was later to market, or do you think there's a different reason for that?
I think that's a factor of the fact that GCP had a very strong offering for a managed Kubernetes service very, very early on. It's also a factor of the fact that AWS has been running EC2 for so many years and people adopted Kubernetes into their EC2 clusters. In the report, these numbers are normalized against 100%, but EKS has had an enormously fast uptake. It's 50% of usage, but that's really because people already had established Kubernetes clusters on their AWS cloud. Some are moving to EKS, some new adoption is happening in EKS, but EKS has proved to be a very popular product. And based on the strength of that observation and on GKE, I do personally think that the control plane for Kubernetes doesn't really have to be something that customers manage. We can think about it as the hypervisor. And as we move forward, that's more and more going to be a common pattern, right? Where people don't necessarily need to tweak everything in their control plane. They just want a managed control plane and they want a data plane that they can provision. Even that, actually, I might put a caveat on. But for now, anyway, they just want a data plane to run their apps and not really worry about becoming people who can manage Kubernetes as experts on Kubernetes.
Something people may like to tweak is the resources that are allocated to their pods and their containers. Your survey says here that 49% of containers use less than 30% of the CPU that's requested, and 45% of containers use less than 30% of their requested memory. This will be comparable to what we saw in Borg studies years ago, which eventually led to the development of things like autopilot and have influenced autoscaling in Kubernetes. Is this a user configuration problem? Is this something that people should be thinking about, or is the technology letting them down?
In every technology problem is a product problem. I think there is a degree to which two migrations happen. One is a lift and shift into containers and Kubernetes, and the next is optimizing Kubernetes. That's sort of natural based on my anecdotal interviews. People do think in the back of their head about optimization, but in terms of putting that into practice, they are more worried about making sure that this is a wildly difficult migration. People have stateful services and stateless services, and it's much easier to move stateless services. But once you've done that, you have a bunch of pods that represent web services jumping around and connecting to Kafka queues that are outside of the cluster or something. I think people are still getting their hands around what this means. And definitely the more sophisticated customers that I talk to are already doing bin packing. Datadog does actually quite a bit of bin packing ourselves and optimization here, but that's a secondary milestone for a lot of people. And what you see here is the immaturity of the ecosystem. Now, I think you can certainly make the argument that tooling accelerates those milestones, right? Good tooling makes it so that you don't have to schedule these things in series. So we are at Datadog, and one of the reasons that I put this fact in the report is we are at Datadog looking into this, how we can help our customers with this without them having to know what to query and know what it means to binpack. We can just push suggestions, something we're heads down on now.
I remember seeing a graph of the amount of memory perhaps that was allocated to containers, and it's got little spikes at 10 and 100 and 1000 because humans say, I don't know how much memory my container needs. Let's give it a round number.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think it's fun. I also see that people are much more afraid of memory. CPU on one hand is more volatile, but memory fails more catastrophically, right? When you broach a memory limit, the killer comes for you. Whereas with a CPU, you'll get throttled. And if the number of cycles you need comes back down, you just have more time to either scale up or handle the load. So you want to hit your limits all the time. I'm just saying it's slightly less catastrophic. So it's interesting to see these patterns, both the round numbers and the fear of one over the other. There's also a hidden story here, right? There is a network, right? Computers exist in the cloud, and Kubernetes doesn't necessarily isolate for network issues. So as people are moving their stateful service into the cloud, as web servers and proxies all live in the same place, if two pods that are highly network constrained happen to be scheduled to the same host, you can quite easily get noisy neighbor problems. So even in these requests and limits that we were able to study, we know anecdotally that there are blind spots and that might appear on future reports.
Another fact from this report says that the most popular Kubernetes version is 17 months old. So 1.19 was the latest release at the time of this publication, and the version with the largest number of users was 1.15 at the time. Now, that version is more than three versions old, so that's outside the general accepted support window. Do you think that's a piece of data that maybe the Kubernetes community should use to consider how long they're supporting versions?
Hopefully it's helpful. I don't want to be prescriptive, certainly. There are people who know a lot more than me about this topic, and then I know that they're taking mindful decisions. I do think it shows the maturity of the ecosystem, and it also shows the velocity of the ecosystem, right? Kubernetes cuts releases very frequently, and that's great for innovation. This is still a platform-level technology that touches every part of a customer's ecosystem and is going to represent some inertia. And I think that makes sense. As we get new versions, we'll see the average customer falling slightly further behind until it stabilizes. Look how many people aren't using a Linux of a kernel or whatever that can't run BPF products, right? There is some lag there, and that's because changing the underlying infrastructure, not just like revving a single application, has a larger potential impact on the company, and people just have to plan for these things.
Now, the last fact in the report is talking about the most widely used images in containers. And it says that we have Nginx, which makes sense as a stateless serving product. And then numbers 2 and 3, Redis and Postgres, where we start getting into data storage in containers. I guess I'm a little surprised by that. Do you see that people are starting to adopt stateful storage in Kubernetes and treat it like it's nothing now?
Treat it like it's nothing is doing a lot of heavy lifting there. I think this is one of the things that people do build expertise on.
There's no fear, perhaps. Is that a better way to think about it?
There is a fear, is what I'm saying.
Right.
The benefits outweigh the risks. There's a risk either way, right? There's a fear when I move all of my stateless services into containers, all of a sudden I have to route through the ingress through the cluster. I have two systems. I have traditional infrastructure that I have to train my engineers on, and we provision that with Chef or Ansible, and I provision my applications through Kubernetes deployments over here. There's a lot of organizational and structural reasons to move those stateful services over also. Also, I think a lot of workloads simply are stateful services, right? So when you look at Redis, Postgres, Elasticsearch, MySQL, it's much more than the top two, RabbitMQ, Mongo. Almost everything here is stateful. The reality is that stateful services underpin all data storage and communication. Kafka and RabbitMQ and the message queuing, they connect them, but nonetheless, they're stateful, if not quite as durable. But you can't really reason about most applications without considering their stateful services. I think what you're seeing there isn't necessarily people not being afraid or a lack of complexity, so much as the importance of doing so and how many stateful workloads there are out there.
This is obviously looking at things that are running on Docker. Do you think that this is roughly representative of open source software in general, perhaps running outside of Docker as well?
Yeah, I suspect so. I don't really have a number on that. I do know that you look at these container images and you wouldn't be surprised by any of them running in a traditional deployment, except for, you know, Calico, for instance, which is more specific to this technology. So that's really just to say that as people move to containers, they are moving everything and not just their stateless services. But I also want to caution that I have not personally done this study outside the container world. And what I'm normalizing against here is my experience in talking to people.
Now, you've talked a bit about how you use this information internally to work on Datadog products. Do you have any idea of how other people outside Datadog have used the information in these reports?
A lot of people are looking for confidence at some first order, right? Even if you don't take any action, you want to know that you have made a good decision. People are working in isolation. There's some collaboration in the industry, certainly. But when we say everybody is using this, it makes people more comfortable to say, yep, I did the right thing there. Everything's okay. And I actually do hear that quite a bit. Are people using Calico? We chose to use Calico. I chose to use Terraform. Are other people? And for me, sitting where I do and talking to so many people, like, yes, of course, everybody uses something like a Terraform. And I'm surprised when people ask me that question. But nonetheless, it's something that people ask. So these kind of facts are helpful for that. And I think also going back, not just to the container images one, which is, I got a recency bias there in answering this, but also in the move to Fargate or the provisioning of limits on individual containers, there is a certain amount that people are recognizing that, yes, they are making the right decisions. Then the other thing is making new decisions. Should we invest in Kubernetes or ECS? Are people trusting Fargate? Is it okay for me to move to a managed control plane and just work with my container image, or is that going to bite me in some way? As we see a lot of these stats, people do take actions based on what they see in this report. Again, the purpose of the report isn't necessarily to prescribe actions, just to give people data for their own benefit.
Finally, you're in New York City. How are the streets?
Oh, it's not bad. Yeah, we just we had some snow the last couple of days, but it's
some snow. That sounds like an understatement.
Yeah, it's been a quiet winter. With everybody being at home, it's been a very quiet winter.
Am I not right in thinking that this is now in the top 20 snowstorms of all time?
Oh, I don't know about that. I remember our April Fool's storms and all of that. So maybe it's time of year, but I think in February we all expect to get snow. And, you know, since I'm locked inside in my tiny studio apartment anyway, right? It's not impacting me the same way as usual.
Do you at least have a pretty view out the window?
It is. It's beautiful out here. Yeah, I love being in New York.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Michael.
Thank you very much for having me. This was a pleasure, Craig.
You can find Michael on Twitter at MikeZVI, although be warned, he's only tweeted 7 times. And you can find Datadog at datadoghq.com. Thank you very much, Saad, for helping out with the show today.
No problem. I had a lot of fun. Thanks, Craig.
If you enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out the website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you will find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe.
I'll be back with another guest host next week. So until then, thanks for listening.